we got a new Beatles song. I can't believe we're talking about the Beatles. This is at the end of 2023, if I'm not mistaken. But you know, John Lennon recorded a really corrupted vocal before he tragically died, and it was just kind of there. And because of some stem separation tech that is only possible because of machine learning, they were able to clean up the vocals, fully on board with this, the John Lennon estate and the remaining Beatles members, and there's a few others. But these are it's interesting. It's just it's a new way of engaging with audio that people, fans are showing that they really like.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I understand that it is making a lot of things possible that would have been impossible before.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Drew Thurlow. My next guest is a former professional musician turned music executive and strategist. He served as senior vice president of A&R at Sony Music and has held leadership roles at both Pandora and Warner Music. A graduate of Brown University with a master's in technology and leadership, he blends creative insight with business acumen. His writing has appeared in Billboard, and he remains a sought-after voice on the intersection of music, tech, and innovation. His first book, Machine Music: How AI is Transforming Music's Next Act, will be published in 2026. His name is Drew Thurlow, and he's also a fellow jury member for the International Sound Awards, which is how we met. As someone on the forefront of how music and technology are blending, I know he'll have a lot of great advice for sound creatives wanting to make their mark, now and into the future. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available, along with other interesting bits of audio-related news. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with Drew Thurlow.
Welcome, Drew. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Me as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So I like to start off the podcast by asking you if you have an early memory of how sound moved you. Do you have one of those?
I have several. Many.
You can talk about any of them that you want. I'm here for it.
I'm riding the back of my parents' car and being able to tune out the world with early Sony Walkman, and how that was my escape, and even being older and starting to play instruments and noticing the world around me was very musical, and not just other musicians, but things like bird songs or the hum of traffic, or even like you hear a noise and it's a tone is in a key, and you hear things match up throughout the day. And some of it, sometimes it's dissonant and sometimes it creates a triad, and it's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Any others from like early childhood that come to mind?
It's definitely really drawn to music. My earliest memories are all around music, either songs or artists. I was the age where, you know, Michael Jackson was at his height when I was very little. You know, I was too young when Thriller came out. I wasn't really sentient, but I just remember being very young and knowing that there was this massive figure that was culturally important and beloved, and it was really mattered. And there was something that I was really drawn to about an artist and a musician that could captivate a public and a culture to that degree before I even really kind of knew what music was.
So you decided to become a musician, right? What informed that decision?
I don't even know if it was really a decision. I mean, it's just kind of something that I really was drawn to. And I just loved playing music. And I started playing guitar first when I was about 13, and I just really just took to it. I was one of those kids who just didn't have idle time without a guitar in my hands. And I didn't think too much about it. I wasn't super self-reflective about it. I just kind of like followed my instincts and continued to do that.
So what was the shift like then when you started working behind the scenes?
Yeah, that was interesting because as much as I like playing music, and I still do, when it has to become your livelihood, then it's just a different calculus. And the things that I really liked about playing my instrument were not necessarily the things that I liked about doing it professionally. And I had some extraordinary run as a musician, and I got to do some amazing things, whether performing on TV or festivals and getting to play on recordings that people have heard. But that is very much divorced from you're sitting in a van for hours on end and you're playing shows. And if your whole day is about that show and it doesn't go well, it's a bad day. And a lot of idle time, a lot of sitting around, even when things were going well, you know, you don't feel it the same way if you're busy off in Topeka. You might be on the cover of back then I was on the cover of a magazine in New York. You might be in like Topeka on tour, and that's not the same thing. So I was just really curious about the other side of it, how this business was structured around the love that I had for performing and playing. And I was just curious about it. And in the industry, there's just like a lot more. You can do a lot more. You can be a lot busier. You can control your fate a lot more, too, to be honest. So I didn't stop playing. I haven't stopped, but I certainly don't. It's nice now because I can just play if I want to. And I still do session work occasionally, and I don't have to worry about doing things I don't want to do for money. And so it's just completely different. It was the right choice for me. I certainly have a lot of respect for the artists who have stuck with it because it's really hard.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So
it is.
And I made a different choice, but I have a lot of respect for those artists. But for me, it was just I had a different path.
Sure. What were one of the, did you have a performance or something that is particularly memorable for you when you were out as a gigging musician?
Yeah, several. Some of them, you know, was what you would expect. Like I got to play Letterman, right? That's like, you know, grew up watching Letterman, then I got to do it. And you know, I played Bonnaroo, things like that. So those Bowery Ballroom in New York, iconic venue. And we used to see shows there. I've probably been there 300 times in my life, and I've probably played there, I don't know, maybe 15. That's always really special, even though it's not necessarily, you know, it's 550 cap room, but it means a lot culturally. Or same thing with Irving Plaza, playing there. I've played there about maybe 5 times. That's been really fun. But a lot of the, some of the moments of like the serendipitous moments you have as a musician where everything kind of works well and it's, you're really clicking, and the hard work you've put into the writing and the rehearsing and the recording, you really become kind of an expert. You put your 10,000 hours in. I've certainly had moments like that that are really fulfilling.
Yeah, I guess that would be being in the flow, right?
Right, yeah. That's the way you would describe it now, yeah.
Yeah, so A&R then, so how did that work, and how has that evolved? Because definitely things are different from maybe when you started doing that to today.
Yeah, I mean, it's so I was working, you know, I was in New York, and I was like, had been affiliated with Atlantic. We had the band I was in had been offered a contract and didn't really work out, but I was, you know, in the community in New York, and I was involved in some other more successful projects in the city, and I was a little bit of a known entity, and I was curious about the business. So I took a job as an assistant at Warner Music Group when I was 23 or 24, and I was learning, and I had an aptitude for music. I could really identify with artists. I had done a lot of the stuff that we were asking them to do as a label. I had done it, so I had some credibility. So I started doing A&R, and this was 2000, you know, mid-2000s, 2007, 8, 9, when I was doing the first time, and it was just very different. It was like, you almost have to forget about the industry today and think about it as a completely different business in post-streaming, because back then it was still, we were selling iTunes downloads, we were also selling physical media, and it was a manufacturing and distribution business to retail, and you could use your ears. We didn't have a lot of data on fans. There was a blogosphere, but it was limited. So you were still really using your ears and you're using your judgment and you were hearing something and you were thinking, all right, I can see where this audience would be. It was also like way less music was coming out. And then, so like I did left of center A&R. So I wasn't doing like mainstream pop right away or even really hip hop, but I was working with like indie rock and I had, you know, the roster that None Such had was great. It was like David Byrne and Wilco and the Black Keys and Bjork and Emmylou Harris and some world music and jazz. And it was, you could hear, you, if I wanted to sign a songwriter, you could hear everything in the Americana songwriting community that came out that year. There was a limited amount of music. So you would hear a demo and you could kind of get a sense of the context of where it fit into the community. And now, you know, my last A&R job, I was senior vice president of A&R at Sony up until 2 years ago. And I mean, it couldn't have been more different. It was a data-driven, analytics-driven job. Very, you know, I often knew very much about a song or an artist before I even heard a note, which would have been anthema to me pre that. So it's changed dramatically.
So when there's that much of a difference, where does the music come in? I mean, because it sounds to me like so much of it was, like you said, you were listening so much in the beginning and now it becomes data. Where is the musician in all this these days? I'm curious as to your take on that, because it's a very different game now, obviously.
I would say that, of course, it still matters. You have to, at the end of the day, the song or the artist has to appeal to music fans. And if you're bad or you're terrible, then that's probably not going to happen. But we just have a way of measuring that a lot sooner and a lot earlier than we used to. We don't have to take those big bets in the recorded music industry.
But I'm curious about the measurement. Like, how do you measure?
You measure by like what the fans are reacting to. So mm-hmm. I'm at Sony and I want my investment, both in terms of the dollars that the company is going to commit in an advance or recording session and the opportunity cost that my team is going to have to work on this project. I want that to matter. I want to have evidence that we're going to be able to make a difference and grow that artist's career. And we know much better now ahead of the time if that is plausible, because we have social data, we have streaming data, and as simple as our artists discovering this, our fans discovering this artist and then following them on TikTok and Instagram. Are they streaming their music on Spotify? That's a one-to-one comparison for someone liking music. So then you can kind of make your judgment calls from there. But as far as the artistry of everything, I mean, I will say the correlation between musical talent and success has never been more dubious. It's just
true.
Because artists are these days, there's the whole influencer thing wrapped up in it. And the way people, especially Gen Z and younger millennials, fall in love with personalities and artists are different. And it's not necessarily bad, it's just different. But it's just listening to something that I think is artistically phenomenal would have been enough 15 years ago. And today, like, you need that and the market research to show that there's an audience for it.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Caput, a filmmaker, composer, and music producer. And I want to thank you for listening to the Audio Branding Podcast, your best place to learn about using the power of sound to tell your story.
So what does a musician need these days to really be that popular? What do you think are the best traits for them to have?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to a lot of, you know, younger musicians who like want me to give them like a matrix of things that if you do this, that, and this, then this is your, and there's just no
I'm
good
sure it's
answer.
Not that easy. Yeah.
No, I mean, like it's people have just, the music fans are fickle. Like, we don't never know what's going to connect. But the advice that I got and the advice that I give is like, you have to be an artist in the very descriptive sense of the word. You have to spend your time making good music and get better. So many artists overlook that fact. You have to be good at it. You have to make compelling things to listen to. And I don't blame them from getting caught up on the TikTok numbers and the influencer stuff. But at the end of the day, like, you need to create something worth listening to. And then, of course, there's like tried and true ways that music fans meet new artists. And that's through social media, making sure that your social media profiles reflect who you are, making sure that you're representing yourself authentically, making sure that you're releasing music in a cadence that keeps you in front of mind. And it's a lot. It's hard work. It's a lot to do.
Oh, yeah.
And it's usually takes a long, long time to find an audience.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I imagine tenacity would be a big part of that. Just showing up regularly.
Right. I mean, that's probably a good lesson for anyone in any walk of life, right? Just don't give up.
Don't give up. Yeah.
that's definitely true in the creative arts and the music.
Yeah. Things are changing so fast, though. And then we have AI coming onto the scene with all of its complexities. And I know you're writing a book about this. So can you talk about the book a little bit and where your stance is on AI with music?
Yeah, sure. I left Sony about 2 years ago and I started my own company and wasn't really sure what I was going to be doing, but it coincided with this AI revolution. And it's been interesting. Now I'm spending most of my time writing, thinking, consulting about music, emerging tech and AI. And I advise a music tech investment fund and I've written for Billboard about it. And now I have this book coming out called Machine Music, How AI is Transforming Music's Next Act. It's coming out in March of 26, supposedly. If you thought the music industry had challenges, the book publishing industry is not far behind.
So I'm sure.
Who knows? But it is really interesting. And I wrote the book because first of all, I got an offer to write it. So that was easy. But I just wanted to get my thinking in order about what this all meant. And not only just what it meant for the music industry, but for artists and creators in the writing process and the recording process. So, and it was really illuminating doing the research. And I'm old enough that I remember the Napster era. And I saw that I was, in college when that all went down. But
I had a songwriting website at the time. A songwriting resource was called The Muse's Muse. Yeah, I watched the whole thing go down in the songwriting community. It was not fun for anyone.
And whenever someone whines about Spotify today not paying artists fairly, I mean, the fact that we've outsourced the entire commercial music business to a streaming service is problematic. But if you really have a problem with streaming, you don't want to go back to the file sharing days. That was a lot worse. It was just a lot worse. But the AI is just the couple of things that I really want people to know about music and AI. Number one, it's a little bit more of a continuation of just what we're already seeing. I mean, there's been revolutions in emerging tech throughout the history of recorded music and the music industry. And this is just kind of more of the same. Moves a little faster. It's a little bit more dramatic. I would liken it to probably how disruptive and transformative the internet was. But I don't think anyone needs to be afraid of it. Number two, I really do think it's being managed properly. Unlike file sharing, the people are taking it seriously. The governments, especially in Europe and the EU, have really good now laws around managing AI holistically. There's been a few laws statewide here in the States.
And Canada still has to figure it out.
Right?
Yeah. Canada still has to figure things out. But I know, for instance, NAVA, which is the National Association of Voice Actors, has been in Washington actually promoting AI, basically laws that protect the voice in general. But it's really all about our personal IP, our personal stuff, your likeness, your voice. All of this should be your property, and there up until very recently really have not been any laws about that at all because it wasn't needed.
Right. Very few. But I think I'm encouraged because, everyone in music and AI likes to talk about this Drake and the Weeknd Heart on My Sleeve song. I mean,
there's more. We'll talk
I know.
More.
And that was 2 years ago. whenever I read an article and it starts with that case study, I'm like, guys, this is 2 years ago, but it was not illegal back then. And that is now illegal. It's because
they did it.
Because they actually, especially state laws in California and Tennessee and some other places and in the EU have taken action. And you're right. We didn't really, your name and likeness was protected. It has been your voice that just never came up. So the industry is managing a lot better. The funding that is going to startups who are working in this stuff is going to companies that are doing it ethically by and large. And I'm just really optimistic about how these tools are going to democratize creativity and creation how it's going to create new markets. And that does not mean that there's not going to be some people whose livelihoods are at stake. And that's something that we also have to manage and have empathy for. Also true, anytime there's any kind of new emerging tech in anything. So it's not new. But I'm just really encouraged and excited about how it's going to impact the arts and the creativity. And I don't think it's going to replace real artists. And there's a lot of good evidence to that effect.
Well, to that effect, I want to ask you what you think about the Velvet Underground. Isn't that what they're called? Or the Velvet Sundown. That's what they're called. Sundown. The Velvet Underground. Yeah, I like that one, too. But yeah,
I know,
the Velvet Sundown. Yeah. So apparently it's all AI. I mean, it was obvious that the photos were, but the music apparently is also all AI. So I don't know. What do you think of that?
Yeah. So this is very triggering for me because
I'm sure it is.
I feel like people just need to stop.
Yeah.
Right. So let me just lay out some facts, that things that we can know. Number one, we've had more than 2 years of generative AI music now. And I would estimate, very roughly estimate, that there's about 30 million or so wholly generated AI songs on DSPs now. And that's there's about 250 million songs overall in the catalogs of these DSPs. So it's a big percentage. From our best, really good estimates by Deezer, places like Deezer and Spotify, AI generated music, even though it's a measurable percentage of all the songs on DSPs, are 1/3% of the royalty pool. And I just want to reiterate that it is a rounding error. Nobody wants this music. It doesn't mean it doesn't have value. I made a song on Suno for my 5-year-old's birthday. It was awesome. It was funny. It's personal. It's fan art. It is not replacing artists. Fans don't want to listen to it. DSPs don't want to program it. And the Velvet Underground. There he did it again.
Velvet Sundown. Yeah, I'm doing it too.
Is only a story because we keep talking about a story.
So are they only being listened to then because they're getting this press?
Yes,
like, is that
absolutely
really? Okay.
You know, you can say, well, they have like 300,000 or a million streams now. There's about 1.78 trillion on-demand streams on DSPs every year now. 300,000 is not, it's not even a rounding error. This is a story. I feel like the industry is like trying to create this, look for a reason to create a narrative that AI is replacing humans, because that's a huge anxiety and fear. And I'm here to tell you, as someone who follows this stuff as closely as anyone, there's no evidence after 2.5 years of this that that is what fans want. And there's no evidence that it's happening. It doesn't mean it can't change in the future. But the Velvet Sundown.
I know, we're both going to get it wrong, the whole thing. It's
like,
okay.
Let them be an archetype for like an AI-generated thing. Let the people who made it call it an art project. I don't believe it, but like, it's not, pulling the microscope back a little bit and just looking at the real industry here. AI music has a lot of value. It's cool. It's interesting. It's, the tech is exciting. There's applications for it for real artists in the industry that, you know, we can talk about if you want, but it is not replacing human artists.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
I'd love to talk about that, actually. I am curious. How would you think that musicians would use it to their advantage?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways. I mean, and this is where we start to talk a little bit about, on the other hand, how we do have to talk about livelihoods being disrupted. So, you know, I started my career as a session bass player, and now in Logic Pro, in one of the most popular DAWs, you can generate a bass track with AI directly into the DAW. I think it's a plugin that comes standard with the Logic Pro software now. Same thing with a keyboard generator, and then there's a drum pattern. They've had the drum pattern for quite a while, about 8 years now. But
sampled music has been out for a long time. So that I don't find that as unusual, I guess. Is that a bass track that it can generate as good as what you could do in the studio, or does it matter? That's kind of the question, right?
It is. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not Bootsy Collins, but like that, it's a great way to get ideas. It's a great way to sample. I was talking to someone yesterday, like, you don't have to hire me to come in and play a part. You can demo 70 parts immediately. And yes, that's probably putting some of my work at risk, but think about the creative upside of that. You can just do it all yourself. And personally, I love AI. I mean, I've been able to scale my business in all these cool projects I'm working on in ways that were never possible before using large language models.
I'm curious.
Oh, just like, you know, I've sold my first book. I'm trying to sell my second. I have a third in the works. I make content. I have an agency called Lone Wolves where we have a music industry community around consultants and people looking for work, and we're able to do content, and I'm able to scale a lot of my idea making, and it's exciting and it's interesting, and it keeps me, as you said, in the flow. I don't have to stop. And as someone who's struggled with, you know, I'm not a really technically minded person, as someone who's struggled with technology, just basically using it, and you know, setting up the microphone that we did pre-taping that your listeners won't be able to hear, thankfully, is a good example of that. But it's really exciting. And artists and musicians are going to use it too. And they'll be able to, you know, Roex, which is a company I really like that does automated mixing with AI. And then AI mastering has been probably the first application of AI that we've seen at a consumer level. And if you're an independent artist and you're just getting started, well, now there's... Once you make music and you want to release it, there's legal AI chatbots that can, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, I wouldn't outsource all of my legal work to a chatbot, but there's like a couple of companies that are trained on music industry issues that you can use as a guide. There's automated marketing functions now that exist. There's a company called Unheard that I really like. And full disclosure, my music tech investment fund is an investor in that company. And there's another company called Symphony OS, which is similar, that is really good. And they help automate marketing. And if you're trying to be a young artist and you're trying to scale your business, there's too much in the world for you to do, and AI can help you do it. And then on the business side, there's a lot of evidence that these fans want to engage with music in cool and interesting ways. And these AI tech tools allow them to do that. And it's a revenue generating source for. And then I'll end this with some heartwarming tales of vocal model usage.
Oh, please.
As a voiceover artist, Jody, I know that's something that like you're very much focused on. But some like Randy Travis, the country star from the 90s, mm-hmm. was disabled by a stroke and couldn't sing. And they were able to recreate his voice with a vocal model, totally on board. Randy Travis was fully in the loop, and he had his first new song in, I don't know, 15 years, and we got a new Beatles song. I can't believe we're talking about the Beatles. This is at the end of 2023, if I'm not mistaken. But you know, John Lennon recorded a really corrupted vocal before he tragically died, and mm-hmm. it was just kind of there. And because of some stem separation tech that is only possible because of machine learning, they were able to clean up the vocals, fully on board with the John Lennon estate and the remaining Beatles members. And there's a few others, but it's interesting. It's a new way of engaging with audio that fans are showing that they really like.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I understand that it is making a lot of things possible that would have been impossible before. I know, for instance, even in the voiceover industry, a lot of guide tracks now are done with an AI voice, with a synthetic voice, which is fine. Well, that's fine, though, because that's my guide track. It's not. And often it doesn't pronounce the names and the street names and such like correctly, or even the company name sometimes.
That's
but
right.
It's weird. Yeah. But it's a very good way for me to get an idea of where my voice fits in this video and the timing thereof. So I can figure out how my voice would fit while listening to this guide track, and I didn't need to do it, and they didn't need to hire anybody, so that's not money out of their pocket, and I wouldn't have been hired to do that anyway.
I'm
hired for the last thing.
It's a tool that you're using. And I had this other theory, because you mentioned the weird pronunciations. There's a phenomenon where artists use like tech to create new kind of sounds, and like auto-tune is a good example that was developed to help singers stay in tune, and then they used it to create a new sound. And there's this whole kind of like lo-fi 8-bit Nintendo aesthetic that's popular both with like visuals and in music, and the old MIDI sounds, which were supposed to be like acoustic instruments, but they were so rudimentary and bad sounding that now they became their. I have this theory that like with all these AI hallucinations that are happening, that's going to become its own like creative aesthetic, and you're going to start to see like a you know, the AI vocal models, you know, the early AI vocal models, they're like, they just sound bad. They're there's like this warble. It's like super, it's like the highs and the lows are gone. It's like lo-fi mid compressed.
Yeah.
It sounds terrible, but I bet in like 8 years, someone's going to be paying a lot of money for a AI vocal model plugin to make that aesthetic sound as an artistic treatment.
This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.